Hello, everyone, or possibly at this point, just my mom. Hi, mom. And welcome to Good Nightmare, a podcast where I talk about all things creepy and strange and mostly historical. I apologize in advance for any quiet little bell rings or meows. That's my cat Maud in the room with me. He's come to join us for some podcasting fun. So today's topic that I wanted to start with, because it's one of my favorite stories from history, one of my favorite unsolved true crimes. Not the first one that got me into true crime, but definitely one of the more influential ones in the past couple of years. And that is the story of Lizzie Borden. So the story of Lizzie Borden and the brutal murder of both of her parents is infamous. It's likely that you've either heard the case itself, or you've seen the Netflix series, or read a novel about it, or some other adaptation at some point. And while the case is considered unsolved, Lizzie Borden has been condemned for years by the general public, many of whom believe wholly in her guilt. She was actually acquitted at trial in record time by a jury of her peers, which leads me to believe that there's much more to the story than simply an angry woman with an axe. Lizzie's father, Andrew, grew up with modest livings. He struggled with money as a young man, though he was born to wealth. He believed in making a name for himself and building his own empire, which he did. He made his fortune making furniture and caskets, ironically, and ended up owning several textile mills as well. By the time he died, his estate was valued at $300,000, which is approximately $18 million as of 2016. Andrew was known for being frugal with his money. There was no indoor plumbing in his house on the ground or second floor, and he lived near his businesses in a more industrial area. As in modern society, industrial areas are not considered to be particularly desirable. For example, I live on the industrial side of Melbourne. Our roads are poor compared to the east, our landscapes go untouched, and we're surrounded by farms and factories. On the other side of town, houses are mansion-like, roads are impeccable, and even the air is cleaner. Most affluent people in Andrew Borden's time were living further from the industrial area, in a place considered much more fashionable and desirable. Andrew's frugality didn't win him any friends. He was disliked by many people in town, and I can't imagine that living with him was any better. Lizzie Andrew Borden was born July 19, 1860. She was the younger of Andrew's two daughters with his first wife. Lizzie and her older sister Emma, Lenora Borden, were brought up under religious conditions, though nothing out of the ordinary for the time. Lizzie, in fact, was very involved in the church and actually taught Sunday school to children who had immigrated to America. She was active in her community and well known and liked, though sometimes considered a little bit strange. Lizzie's mother, Andrew's first wife, died in 1863 when Lizzie was barely 3 years old. Lizzie would not remember her mother, but she would come to know her stepmother well enough, Abby Durfee Gray. Lizzie was recorded as saying that she believed that Abby was only after her father's money and she would only call her stepmother, not mother, and definitely not by name. This later indicated to investigators, and I guess the general public, that their relationship was civil at best. Lizzie was known for faking illness in order to avoid family dinners, and apparently her stepmother especially. I can't imagine this kind of behaviour is unusual, even for an adult, who might dislike a person living under their roof, and I can definitely say I've avoided a few conversations myself, though I've never been accused of murder because of it. Lizzie was a little bit strange, and possibly childlike as an adult. In 1892, when she was 32 years old, she built a pigeon coop to keep pigeons as pets. A little bit odd, maybe, but nothing to indicate that anything was wrong with her, especially not that she would have violent tendencies. Her father, Andrew, however, wasn't exactly a fan of the pigeons, and he was pretty violent. He believed that the pigeons were attracting local kids who wanted to hunt them. He considered the children pests and decided that the best option was to kill all the pigeons with a hatchet in order to stop the children coming by. A little bit extreme, if you ask me. Naturally, Lizzie was upset. She'd built a coop to care for her pigeons, and rather than releasing them and dismantling the coop, Her father had destroyed everything in one big bloody mess. Possibly a motive for Lizzie, but probably more of just a tragedy. Lizzie and her sister, who were considered spinsters at the time, as neither were married and both over 30, decided to take a short vacation together after a family argument. Not unusual to want to get out of the house after a fight, though it has been suggested that this was part of their murderous plan. The sisters returned home just a week before the murders. During the time they were away, Andrew had been gifting various amounts of real estate to his wife Abby's family, which kind of solidifies the idea that she may have just been in the marriage for money. But can we really blame her? Most marriages back in that day were about securing a future, especially in terms of finances. The Borden house was a busy one leading up to the murders. Enter second suspect, John Vinicum Morse. Andrew's brother John visited the family home. He was to stay some time to discuss business with his brother. You can only imagine that his brother selling off property that John may feel entitled to could cause some tension. I wasn't able to find too much information about the relationship between the brothers, but from experience, I can tell you that when money gets involved in family relationships, it's likely that the family members could easily turn on each other. And this is where things start to get weird, or weirder. Only days before the brutal murders took place, the entire Borden family had taken ill, including Lizzie. It was suggested that this may be due to food poisoning from eating old mutton, which sounds bad enough. But Abby was paranoid, and perhaps rightly so, and she believed that they'd all been poisoned. That kind of sparks the idea that they may have had other enemies around the town, or perhaps in their own home. The maids were also said to be quite disgruntled by the way that they were treated by the Bordens. On Thursday, the 4th of August, 1892, Abby and Andrew were murdered. Abby was said to have been facing her killer when she was struck with a weapon. This caused her to fall face down on the floor, where she was struck another 19 times in the back of the head, said to have taken place between 9 and 10:30 a.m. Andrew was murdered between 10:30 and 11:10 a.m. Apparently, he was chatting with his brother in the sitting room for about an hour prior to his murder. Morse then went for an hour or so walk at 9 a.m. When he returned, conveniently after both murders had taken place, he claimed his key wouldn't work in the front door lock. It was apparently the housemaid who came to the door and discovered the body of Andrew Borden, saying that when she swore, upon the shock of it, she believed that she heard Lizzie laughing upstairs. And this itself is questionable due to Lizzie's alibi and own testimony, which we'll come to in a moment. What makes John suspicious is not only that he had motive, time, and a convenient alibi, but also that we know from cases such as that of JonBenet Ramsey that people who may be involved in a murder will often bring a witness to discover the body with them or for them. As for Lizzie's alibi, Lizzie claimed that she was in the loft in the barn eating peas while this took place. Police didn't believe her, though there were witnesses who confirmed that Lizzie was not in the house at the time of the murder. There are multiple contradictory testimonies from witnesses about what happened and when. Not exactly unusual, as we all know that eyewitness testimonies can be unreliable. Lizzie was not thoroughly investigated or checked for bloodstains during the investigation, as she was unwell and was confined to her room. The police were obviously criticised for not being thorough in their investigation. In the days following the crime, Lizzie burned a dress she owned that she claims was covered in paint. Eating peas in a loft makes burning a dress seem a little bit less out of character, so does owning pigeons, and back then, I guess, being an unmarried woman over 30. It was never determined whether this was the dress she was wearing the day of the murders. No one had thought to inspect it when they had the chance, and Lizzie was officially a suspect. On August 11, she was arrested and jailed. On June 5th, 1893, trial began. Some notes from the trial and investigation that only served to complicate the case follow. The hatchet found in the basement was not convincingly shown to be the murder weapon. There was no bloody clothing found, but as I said, Lizzie had burned a dress on the stove, claiming that it was covered in paint. According to the maid, Bridget, she went upstairs around 10:58 a.m. and left Lizzie and her father downstairs. Lizzie had told many people that this is the time she went into the barn to eat peas and wasn't in the house for 20 minutes or possibly half an hour. Hyman Lubinsky testified for the defense that he saw Lizzie leaving the barn at 11:03, and Charles Gardner confirmed the time. At 11:10 a.m., Lizzie called the maid downstairs and told her Mr. Borden had been murdered and told her not to go into the room where he died, but instead sent her to fetch a doctor. Because of the mysterious illness that had struck the household before the murders, the family's milk and Andrew's and Abby's stomachs, which were removed during autopsy performed in the Borden's dining room, were tested for poison. None was found. And just one last fun fact, the victims' heads were removed during autopsy. The skulls were used as evidence during trial, and upon seeing them, Lizzie fainted, naturally. The heads were later buried at the foot of each grave. At trial on June 20, after only 90 minutes of deliberation, Lizzie was acquitted of her charges. She chose to live her remaining days in the same town that she grew up in, facing rumors, ridicule, and there was even a nursery rhyme about the bloody murders. Upon her death in 1927, Lizzie left $30,000, the equivalent of $555,000 in 2016, to the Fall River Animal Rescue League, and $500, $9,000 today, in trust for perpetual care of her father's grave. Her closest friend and a cousin each received $6,000, $111,000 today. Lizzie remains the prime suspect in the public court, I guess, regardless of being acquitted. But there were multiple people in that town and in that house that could have easily committed the crime. Some suggest that the maid killed the parents out of frustration at her working conditions. Morse had a convenient alibi and at the time was also considered a suspect. In fact, he remains a suspect to this day as the case is still unsolved and he was never ruled out. So, if Lizzie claims to have been out of the house, which was corroborated by two witnesses, why was she the main suspect? Probably because she was a woman, a spinster, and more than a little bit weird. Her guilt seems to sit somewhere between a possibility and a witch hunt. My main theory, and it's quite a popular one, is that the killer was in fact John Vinnicum Morse. If not himself, then someone he may have hired. And as for motive, Andrew Borden was originally married to Morse's sister. That was his first wife. Perhaps Morse felt entitled to her share of the land and money, which instead was now going to the new wife and her extended family. This might have been an affront to him, him being more closely related and especially related by blood to Borden's daughters. I've seen people fight over less and kill over much less. There was the equivalent of millions of dollars at stake, and Morse wasn't getting a dime. Lizzie and Emma would have been much easier to dupe out of their inheritance or to scam money from. There's something about all the convenient excuses he was able to make that I just don't trust. Call me biased, because I am, but I have a bit of a soft spot for Lizzie, and something tells me that she could have been the scapegoat for a crime that she didn't commit. I feel her innocence is confirmed by both her alibi and her acquittal. But I'm curious. What do you think? Be sure to check out the Lizzie Borden Chronicles on Netflix and See What I Have Done, the novel by Sarah Schmidt, for some entertaining takes on the case. Don't forget to subscribe, rate and review, and email me at goodnightmare_s@outlook.com with your historical crime stories, mysteries, or any suggestions. You can also follow me on social media at goodnightmare. Thanks for listening and sweet dreams.
Chunka 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 chunka.
Whoa, Meg, what are you on the computer for? You know that's not for kids.
I'm on the internet and I'm looking at my favorite podcast, which is called Nightmare on Fear Street. It's about all of the rad, spooky, unreal books that me, as a cool 90s teen, loves to read.
Books like what?
Well, like Goosebumps, the Fear Street series, and other series like Bone Chillers and Hairraisers and even The Shadow Zone by J.R. Black.
I hate that guy. What a nerd.
Yeah, but you know who's not a nerd?
Who? Who's not a square?
You, if you listen to Nightmare on Fear Street.
Whoa, radical, tubular, excelsior.
And the best thing is, because it's on the internet, you can get it whenever or wherever you want to listen to it. So even if you're at Time Zone playing arcade games, or if you're doing sick tricks on your board, or even if you're going down to the McDonald's.
I hear they just put it in an N64 so I could play Pokemon Snap.
Unreal!
Radical. Right, I'm going to have to search this. Where can I find this on Magellan?
You can find Nightmare on Fear Street on iTunes, Stitcher, and anywhere else where you can download podcasts.
Unreal!
Kids, have you done your homework?
No, because homework is uncool.
Yeah, Mom, we're listening to Nightmare on Fear Street.
And then afterwards, we're going to watch Saved by the Bell, because we're awesome.
And then we both ollie out on our skateboards.
Yeah. I'm Zach.
And I'm Meg.
And we are Nightmare on Fear Street. We're a weekly podcast all on R.L. Stine and spooky scariness.
We are a transoceanic partnership of rad 90s nostalgia for cool teens only.
Only the coolest places, you know, like Australia and America. So you can find us on any podcasting format, and we produce usually weekly. Yeah, unless Cthulhu comes out, and then we're screwed.
And episodes typically come out on a Friday, but if you subscribe, you may also get some cheeky bonus content.
Ooh, bonus content. Awesome. Well, I'm Zach.
And I'm Meg.
And stay spooky. Radical. Oh my god, I went back in time.